Welcome, everyone, to Four Winds Fellowships. I'm Tim Warner. We are in episode 8 in our series on pristine apostolic monotheism, the doctrine of God and His Son, as taught by the apostles in the New Testament, and then was also taught by those who followed the apostles up until at least the end of the second century. Now, last time we were talking about the Gospel of John, chapter 1, and we covered verses 10 through 12. Today I want to focus in this lesson only on verse 12 and really on two key words in verse 12. The first word is ginome. You'll see that at the top of your screen. This is a Greek word that literally means to become, but it's used in really in three major ways in the scriptures. It's used of events. So if an event occurred or happened, that event could be said to have genome or become. And that's easy to understand why that this verb would be used in that sense. It's also used with a nominative noun, that is, something became. We've translated it as originated in John 1. In the verse 3, I believe it is, where it says, all things through him originated, or genome, became. In the past tense, in the aorist indicative, past tense in English, it's egeneta, which we've talked about that in previous lessons quite a bit. But it's the same verb that we're talking about here. Its basic form is genome. Now, it's used with a nominative noun, as I said. That is, when in Genesis chapter 1, when it says that God said, let there be, and then it says, and that thing, whatever it is, egeneta, which is genome in the past tense. That thing occurred, that thing became, that is, it came into being. So genome can be used for something that originated that did not exist before. You can see how that's easily tied to events that did not exist and then they happen, and so it's used that way. But what we want to focus on now is when it's used in a predicate nominative construction, which there are several examples of this in the New Testament. And one of them is in John 1:14, where it says, and the word or logos became flesh. Now, what I want to point out here is, what do I mean by a predicate nominative construction? Well, if you look here, you can see it says, and logos. Logos is the subject of this clause, all right? So logos became flesh. Flesh is the predicate. So what it's essentially saying is something that already existed or someone that already existed became this thing here. So it's not coming into existence from nothingness like it would be used if it didn't have a predicate. But when it has a predicate, it means this, the subject, became whatever the predicate is. All right? And you can see that here. That's very clear in our English translations. So it says, logos became flesh and sojourned among us, and we gazed upon his glory, glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. Notice the only begotten from the Father is a reference to logos here, who became flesh. Now, the thing I want to point out is that whenever ginome is used in this kind of a predicate nominative construction, it refers to something that already exists in the real world becoming something that it was not before. All right, that's the critical point I want to make. And I have two examples of it here to show that that's the case. So we have in Matthew chapter 4, verse 3, where Satan is tempting Christ. He says to him, command these stones to become bread. And he uses this verb, you know, may. So we have stones, they already exist. Become, you know, may, be transformed is essentially what it's saying, into bread. So what we see here is that stones is a concrete noun. Bread is a concrete noun. It is one thing of one essence or one kind becoming something of a different essence or a different kind. And that's what this verb, become, or ginome, used in a predicate nominative statement, that's what it means. This, whatever the subject is, becomes in a transformation, becomes whatever the predicate is. All right? That's easy to see here. We see the same thing in John chapter 2, verse 9, when Jesus turned the water into wine. We have the water, which is the subject, which became, ginome, wine. Again, we have a concrete thing that exists, water, becoming something entirely different, something with a totally different ontological nature, but is yet also a concrete thing. Now, the reason I'm pointing out that it's concrete thing to concrete thing that this transformation is describing is because there are some biblical Unitarians who claim that the Logos, the word in John 1, is a reference to God's plan. In other words, it doesn't have any concrete existence. It's just a thought or a series of thoughts in God's mind that they claim is this word or Logos, and that this abstract thing that has no real concrete existence then becomes the person Jesus Christ in the statement, Logos became flesh. That is their interpretation of that. That is not how this verb is used in a predicate nominative construction. It's not that an abstract thing that has no real existence becomes the predicate. It's that something that has a concrete existence becomes whatever the predicate is. All right, so the point being that these illustrations here of the stones become bread or the water which becomes wine, these illustrations show a concrete to concrete transformation. That is, something that is real, tangible, becomes something else that is real and tangible. They do not illustrate that something that is abstract becomes real or concrete. All right, that's not how this term is used. And those biblical Unitarians who make that claim are wrong. This is not what this phrase means. All right. All right, let's look at this verb also is used in Philippians 2, verses 5 through 8. And this is also an important statement that goes to this transformation of the word or Logos became flesh. That is, the pre-existing Son of God became a human being. He became flesh, a total transformation of his essence or substance. So we see this in Philippians 2, 5 through 8. This is the LGV version we have here. Have this disposition in you, which was also in anointed Jesus, who, being in the form of God, did not consider to be equal with God a prize, but emptied himself, taking the form of a slave, and here's the critical word here, becoming in the likeness of men. Now, what we have here is we have the Son already existed here in the form of God, and he had some sort of equality with God. What that means is really not important to the lesson today. We'll talk about this passage in great detail in a future video. Anyway, he did not consider this equality with God as a prize, something to be held onto. He emptied himself, and these two clauses here, this one and this one, taking the form of a slave and becoming in the likeness of men. These two clauses are aorist participle clauses. They're adverbial clauses. They are actually telling us what emptied himself means. That is, what he did in order to empty himself. These two clauses modify the main verb, which is emptied here. All right. So he emptied himself, comma, and you could put the word by there, by taking the form of a slave and by becoming in the likeness of men. Now you can see that becoming in the likeness of men means that he changed into the likeness of men, something he was not before. Just like the bread was stones before, but afterwards it was no longer stones, right? Same with the water which became wine. It's wine now, it's no longer water. All right. Now, a lot of times biblical Unitarians will object to this and say, oh, well, you're saying that Christ had two origins. No one can have two origins. But that's not technically true. Did this bread have two origins? If stones became bread, then this bread had two origins. It had an origin when it became bread, but it also had an origin prior to that when it was made as a stone, right? So it was first a stone, it became bread, and this is a second origin or a new origin because of a total change in its ontological nature. And so there are two origins for this bread. Same with the wine. The water, which became wine, has two origins. It has an origin at the beginning of creation when God created water to begin with. And then when it became wine, it has a new beginning, a new origin as wine, as something entirely different than what it was before. So this idea that the Son of God could not become flesh because that means he has two origins is not founded upon sound logic, and it's not founded upon correct biblical interpretation either. One of the ways I like to talk about this when people bring that objection up is to say that when in the resurrection, when, let's take Abraham for example, Abraham died, he no longer exists, he turned to dust, he's no longer a conscious being, but he will be raised again as an immortal in the resurrection. So we have a person who was mortal, who ceased to exist, but he is going to become a immortal in the resurrection of the just. In that state, did Abraham have a preexistence? And the answer to that is obviously yes, he had a preexistence. We have a mortal, no longer a mortal, who becomes an immortal, who now has a new beginning, a new existence. Well, if that's the case, why is it so hard for biblical Unitarians to accept the idea that the immortal Son of God became mortal, which is what this passage is actually teaching? And Logos became flesh. He became what we are. That's also what this passage is teaching. He existed already in the form of God. He was considering, that is, he had a conscious existence because he's considering his equality with God. And then he made the choice to empty himself, the result being he takes the form of a slave, and he becomes in the likeness of men, which means he was not in the likeness of men before he emptied himself. All right, that's the critical point. All right, so Trinitarians actually deny what is meant in John 1:14, and also in Philippians 2:5-8. Trinitarians do not believe that Logos, or the Word, became flesh. They agree with us that the Word was a person, was in the beginning with God as the Son. They would agree with that statement. But that he became flesh, again, as I showed with these examples, means a total change in his ontological nature, which means he was not what he was before. See, when we use this verb in this predicate nominative clause, Logos was not flesh before this event, but after this event, when he became flesh, he's not what he was previous to this transformation, just like wine is no longer water, all right? Which is why he had to empty himself, all right? I hope you guys get that. Trinitarians are denying that the Word became flesh. They're essentially saying instead that the Word, or Logos, put on flesh. That is, he simply added something to himself, which is humanity, human nature, an outer garment of flesh, if you will. But that's the opposite of emptying himself. That's adding something to himself, and it is not a becoming. It's not really what genome means. Genome is talking about a total transformation when it's used this way in this predicate nominative clause, okay? So Trinitarians are actually denying what John 1:14 says. Biblical Unitarians are also denying what John 1:14 says, because As I said, those who claim that Logos is not a concrete thing, but just God's plan, becoming flesh. We already demonstrated in previous videos in this series that Logos was God, which is a personal noun, which means Logos had to be a person in order to be called God. So they have an abstract plan, becoming a person, which is an abstract thing, becoming a concrete thing, which is not what this kind of a clause or this verb actually indicates. All right, so they're completely wrong with regard to that. So both Trinitarians and Unitarians are incorrect with regard to that. All right, so let's move on to another slide. I want to talk about this word magnes. We see here, and let's look at the verse again. It says, and Logos became flesh and sojourned among us. This is an interesting word here, sojourned. Sojourned, some translations actually say tabernacled among us. But the word itself is just a verb form of the word that means tent or tabernacle, right? And so whenever it's used in the Bible, it's referring to a temporary sort of a makeshift dwelling. Like you live in a house, but when you travel, you may bring a tent and camp in the tent. And it uses this term here as a sojourned, that Logos became flesh and sojourned among us. Sort of this in and of itself implies that he went from a much higher place to a much lower place to live in a tent as a human, as opposed to his former glory. So that's an interesting word that you should take note of. So it says, Logos became flesh and sojourned among us, and we gazed upon his glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. Now, when did the apostles, now John is the one who's writing this, when did they gaze upon his glory? Well, of course, that's referring to when Jesus took Peter, James, and John, who's the author of this book, up into the mountain and was transfigured before them, and they saw his face shining as the sun, and his garment was as, you know, whiter than anyone could whiten clothing, and that sort of thing is stated about it there. So that's what John's talking about, and he says, we gazed upon his glory, but then he likened it to something. He said, glory as of the only begotten from the Father. That is, what he's saying is, the only begotten from the Father, or from God himself, implies a certain kind of glory. Because God is glorious, if God begat another person from himself, and it has to be from the Father, right? He doesn't say the only begotten from Mary. He says the only begotten from the Father. Well, in Genesis, we see from the very first chapter that this idea of begetting, that kind begets like kind. And so if the Son is the only begotten from the Father, then he has to have been like the Father when he was begotten. He has to be of the same kind as God was. And that implies in itself a certain level of glory. Well, we see that in John 17, in Jesus' prayer to his Father, I believe it's in verse 3 or 4 or 5, right in there, he says to the Father, he prays that the Father would restore to him the glory that he had with the Father before the world was. Now, that statement in and of itself proves pre-existence. Of course, Unitarians will find all kinds of creative ways to try to make that go away. But that's, in fact, what it says there. And this is also what John is talking about here when he says, the glory as of the only begotten from the Father, because the Son was begotten from the Father at the beginning of the creation, as we have already seen. All right, so then full of grace and truth. Now, let's talk about this word only begotten. It's monogenes or monogenes, depending on how some people pronounce it. It's it's from two Greek words, mono, which most of us know what mono means. It means only, right? Solitary. And genao, which means to beget, all right, or begotten. So only begotten is the literal translation of this It's a compound word. It's made up of two words put together to make one word, right? Only begotten is the literal term. All right. Now, the question is does monogenes literally mean only begotten, that is, the sole genetic offspring of a parent? Well, these passages here are the only other places that this appears, other than in John, okay, because I didn't list all the ones in John. But apart from John, these are the places where this term, monogenes, appears in the Bible. It appears in the Old Testament in the Septuagint in Judges 11:34. Now, this is talking about a man who had an only daughter, and it specifically says she was his only begotten. And then the next clause says he had no other sons or daughters. All right, so it clearly defines it. The very first time it appears in Judges, it says that this man had one daughter, he had no other sons and daughters, and uses this word monogenes for it. Now, the reason I'm pointing these things out is because modern Trinitarians have tried to redefine this word, and it's because it causes them problems in John 1:14 and in John 1:18. It creates a problem with Trinitarianism, which we'll talk about in a moment. In Luke chapter 7, verse 12, and in Luke chapter 8, verse 42, and then in Luke 9:38, in all three of those instances, we have examples of someone who is an only child from a parent. In one of them, there is a widow who is mourning, and they're at a funeral for her son, and it says he was her monogenes, her only begotten son. And so Jesus raises this young man from the dead in order, because he had compassion on this widow, because she had no other children except this one child who was her monogenes, her only begotten child. Okay, we see the same thing in Luke 8:42 and in Luke 9:38. All three cases, it's clear in the context that this is an only child from a parent, and that's why the word monogenes is used, only begotten. All right. Now we also have one in Hebrews 11:17 through 18, where Isaac is referred to as Abraham's monogenes, Abraham's only begotten. Now, those who challenge this, that monogenes means only begotten, will point to that passage and say, well, Abraham had Ishmael first, so Isaac could not be his only begotten. And because of that verse, they claim that it means it was his unique son, not his only begotten son. All right. And we'll talk in a minute about why they've done that. But in Hebrews 11:17 and 18, it also talks about the fact that God did not regard Ishmael. That it says that Sarah, by faith, Sarah received strength to, and literally the text says, for the overthrowing of a seed. Most translations say to conceive seed, but it literally says for an overthrowing or casting down of a seed. And that seed that Sarah cast down was Ishmael. Ishmael was no longer considered Abraham's offspring because God had rejected him. And we see this concept actually comes from Genesis, because in chapter 22, when God told Abraham to offer up his son, three times in chapter 22, he refers to Isaac as your only son. Speaking to Abraham, right? Take Isaac, your only son whom you love. So already in Genesis 22, Ishmael is being left out as Abraham's seed, and he was cut off from the covenants and from the promises that God gave to Abraham. And so we see that theme is actually repeated in Hebrews 11:17 and 18. And even after he refers to Isaac as Abraham's monogenes, his only begotten, in the very next verse, he explains why. He quotes from Genesis where God says, for in Isaac your seed will be called. That is, in Isaac alone your seed will be called. So God reckoned Isaac as Abraham's only begotten, his monogenes. And that's the reason why that term is used here. So this is not justification for claiming that monogenes does not mean only begotten. All right. But that is the justification that you will see Trinitarians use. And even in many of our modern Bible translations, they no longer use only begotten. You'll see only begotten in the King James Version, the New King James Version, the New American Standard Version. But in like the NIV and I believe the ESV and a few other translations, they will say something like unique, his unique son. But that's not a correct translation. All right, unique is not the meaning of monogenes. If, for example, take these passages here, Judges 11:34 or any of these, and try putting the word unique in those passages and it makes no sense. All right. For example, in this one, when it's talking about this man who had only one daughter, if it said she was his only begotten or unique daughter, the next clause says he has no other sons or daughters. Well, in order to be unique, you have to be different within a group. So that means there has to be more than one son or daughter in order for this one to be unique among those sons or daughters. See, so the word unique that's used here is wrong because it implies more than one, but monogenes doesn't mean more than one. It means one solitary begotten child from a parent. All right. And then we have of course Psalm 2:7. It doesn't use monogenes, but it does say of Christ, "You are my son. Today I have begotten you." The reason that Trinitarians try to redefine this word, monogenes, is because it doesn't fit their theology either. Because, you know, Trinitarians believe that the Son, God the Son, supposedly, always existed alongside the Father. He did not have an origin. So he could not have been begotten of the Father prior to creation or at the time of creation. He always existed. And the word begotten implies a reproduction, right? It implies procreation. So they don't believe the Son literally came forth out of the Father with regard to, you know, prior to creation or at the time of creation. They don't believe those things. So monogenes doesn't fit with their idea of this co-equal, co-eternal God the Son. Well, they can't use it either with regard to what they call the incarnation, because in the incarnation, they believe that God the Son merely added flesh. That's not a begetting event. It may be a begetting event with regard to Mary, regarding his humanity, but it's not a begetting event regarding coming forth out of the Father, right? Because this verse says, the only begotten from the Father. All right, so they have a problem there. And this is why you will see many translations trying to redefine this word that in all the older translations was translated as only begotten. But now, of course, they're changing it up. Okay, we've already gone over all this here. So Trinitarians deny that Jesus is not literally begotten from God. Trinitarians do not believe, if you try to pin them down, that Jesus is the only begotten Son of God. They don't believe that. They'll fudge on it. And the words only begotten clearly means, as I said, a parent begetting an offspring. And as we said, kind always begets like kind. All right, so that won't work in Trinitarianism at all. Well, it certainly doesn't work in biblical Unitarianism either. Biblical Unitarians deny that Jesus is the only begotten Son of God. In fact, with biblical Unitarians, you can even go so far as to say that Jesus is not the begotten Son of God. He's not even really the Son of God. For biblical Unitarians, Jesus is the adopted Son of God. For them, God created the man Jesus as a special creation. He did not beget the man Jesus. for Biblical Unitarians. All right, so my point is that both for Trinitarians and Biblical Unitarians, they deny what the text of John 1:14 says. Logos became flesh and sojourned among us. We gaze upon his glory, glory as of the only begotten from the Father, full of grace and truth. They deny this. Both of those views deny that Jesus is literally the Son of God. All right. And that's something that ought to give Biblical Unitarians a lot of pause. And Trinitarians, too, should give them a lot of pause, because there's a lot said in John's first epistle about those who deny that Jesus is the Son of God. All right. So it's serious stuff. All right. Well, that's it for today. And we'll pick up with the verses that follow. I want to conclude the prologue of John's gospel. So we'll look at verses 15 through 18 in the next lesson. I want to conclude that. And then after that, I want to go back to the Old Testament and look at wisdom in Proverbs. And then we will take that theme and see what how the New Testament links wisdom in Proverbs 8 to Jesus Christ. All right. So looking forward to that. We'll see you next time. God bless.